O'Hare 45, partly sunny there, in Bloomington 43, at Mattoon 41, in Carbondale 46. 40 degrees at South Bend, at Lafayette and Indianapolis. It was 41 degrees at the top of the hour, and Terre Haute reported 42 degrees. Willard Airport reported a mostly sunny sky, the temperature 42, the dew point 31, the relative humidity 64%, the wind out of the south at 14 miles per hour, and the barometric pressure 30.26 and falling. And at 12:38, 41 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois. We have a mostly sunny sky. A Malaysian company has announced plans to build in Miami, Florida, what it calls the world's largest casino. The developer and other big names in the gaming industry are pushing lawmakers to ease restrictions to allow construction of so-called destination casinos. From Miami, NPR's Greg Allen has this report.
In the center of the city of Miami, along the shores of Biscayne Bay,
in a promotional video, the Genting Group lays out an impressive vision for a resort that would be the largest ever seen in South Florida.
Resorts World Miami will combine iconic architecture, world-class dining and entertainment options.
Genting has already acquired prime Miami real estate and released its proposed design. At its center are six towers with undulating curves that Genting says are inspired by the coral reefs and marine environment of nearby Biscayne Bay. It's a development that would include three hotels, a convention center, more than 50 restaurants, and a swimming lagoon as large as 12 Olympic-sized pools. And that's where the questions begin, with the project's size and its main feature, a casino that would be the largest in the world. Except for those run by Indian tribes and slot machines at racetracks, casino gambling is currently prohibited in Florida. Resorts World Miami president Christian Good says rewriting state law to allow for three destination casinos costing at least $2 billion each would give a big boost to the region's struggling economy.
Our initial estimation is that three destination resorts can create 100,000 jobs. We think that given the climate and the unemployment levels that we see here in South Florida, we see nationwide, we think that's a very important point.
That's the lure, jobs and tax revenue. Days after Genting unveiled its plans, lawmakers in Florida's legislature filed a bill that would allow for three casinos to be built in Miami-Dade and Broward counties. The casinos would be taxed at a 10% rate, delivering, according to one estimate, as much as $250 million a year to the state. In Miami, county officials are mostly positive about Genting's mega development. They want assurances that the county gets its share of tax revenue and that jobs go to area residents. But among others, there's concern about what the development would mean for Miami's economy, particularly for its many hotels and restaurants. The city manager of Miami Beach, George Gonzalez, told the county commission recently that building 5,000 new hotel rooms adds 1.8 million room nights a year to the area's inventory.
Now, the idea that I've been told is that we're not targeting the current visitor. We're going to be bringing new visitors, folks that aren't coming to Miami and South Florida that are big gambling types. Are there really 1.8 million room nights of those types of people in the world?
Since the bill that would allow casinos in South Florida was introduced in Tallahassee, opponents have begun to mobilize. It's a diverse coalition that includes religious conservatives and the Seminole Indians, who operate the Hard Rock casinos in Florida. It also includes several business groups, such as Florida's Chamber of Commerce. One of the chamber's leading members, the Walt Disney Company, says it believes gambling is inconsistent with Florida's brand as a family-friendly destination. The opposition from Disney and the other business groups frustrates State Senator Ellen Bogdanoff. Bogdanoff, a Republican from Fort Lauderdale, is sponsoring the bill. She says because it sets up a state agency that would finally regulate gambling. With Indian casinos, horse and dog tracks, and the growth of quasi-legal storefront businesses offering video poker, Florida, she notes, is already the nation's fourth largest gambling destination.
This is the opportunity to actually control it and harness it for the first time. We have a proliferation of gaming in the state, and I don't even know that the public understands just how much it's growing. It's growing tremendously, and it's growing in the wrong direction.
Given the strong opposition, the prospects for Florida's move to open the state to casino gambling look uncertain. Genting says it plans to go ahead with its massive Miami resort, whether gambling is approved or not. But the mere fact that the state has put casinos on the table has spurred a frenzy of activity. At least two other Las Vegas casinos are actively pursuing opportunities in Miami-Dade and Broward counties. And several other counties in Florida are now exploring their own plans for possible casinos. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
States aren't doing enough to help prevent child sex trafficking. That's the bottom line of a new report out today, which gives a failing grade to more than half the states in the U.S. The study grades every state on whether it has laws on the books to protect children who are pushed into the sex trade and to punish adults who seek out those services. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
Too many states still inadvertently provide a safe haven inside the U.S. when it comes to sex trafficking, even when children on the streets bear the consequences. That's the conclusion of a new study by the advocacy group Shared Hope International, along with the American Center for Law and Justice. Linda Smith is a former Republican member of Congress from Washington State. She founded Shared Hope International after she left Capitol Hill.
I was absolutely shocked when we started sending people into states as sex tourists, and they would go in and they would come into the city, maybe from another country, maybe another state, and they could buy kids so easily.
Smith says she's devoting all her energy to making life harder for criminals and to helping victims, especially children, who are trafficked for sex and domestic work. Laws in Washington State and Texas are strong, she says, but many other states are falling down on the job. Miserably. Lately, she's got an important ally, the National Association of Attorneys General. It's a group made up of the top prosecutors in each state, and this year, they've put the fight against human trafficking at the top of their agenda. Rob McKenna is the Attorney General in Washington State. He says there's a lot of work to be done.
In our understanding of human trafficking, we are today about where we were with the problem of domestic violence about 40 years ago. Low levels of awareness, low levels of law enforcement response, almost no services for victims.
McKenna says the area is so misunderstood that experts still aren't sure how many victims suffer every year. He says estimates start around 100,000 people in the U.S. And around the world, he says, the United Nations and U.S. data show human trafficking ranks only behind narcotics as one of the most lucrative and fast-growing criminal enterprises. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
And you'll find.
Today is World AIDS Day, and in Champaign, the day will be marked by a free showing of the documentary We Were Here about the fight against AIDS when it first appeared in San Francisco's gay community 30 years ago. The 5:30 p.m. showing at the Illinois Terminal Building is sponsored by the Greater Community AIDS Project, or GCAP. Illinois Public Media's Jim Meadows spoke with GCAP's director, Mike Brenner, about the services the organization provides for people with HIV and AIDS, including low-cost housing, food assistance, and emergency financial aid.
A lot of these services are for people who don't have much money to speak of. Is that because they didn't have much money to begin with, or because the medical expenses themselves have been such a drain, or because they haven't been able to work because of the disease?
I think it's a little bit of all three. I mean, there's definitely some people that just didn't really have that much beforehand that become infected, because it does proportionately does affect the lower income socioeconomic class. But also there are some people that had been working for a long period of time, and because the medications or some of the side effects of the medications, they just were not able to work anymore.
How much does the health care for just keeping things together with HIV, how much does that cost?
If you didn't have insurance, I don't think there's a person living in this area that could really afford it, because you're looking at easily $25,000 a year just for the medications, plus then all your doctor's visits and all the lab work and all those kind of things. Fortunately, there are programs out there that help. Carle Clinic is wonderful with their patient assistance programs. Illinois has administers the local AIDS drug assistance program that helps pay for people's medications. Ryan White Act helps pay for doctor's visits and medical visits and those kind of things. So if somebody doesn't have insurance, a lot of the things are covered, and especially if they happen to be in that gray area between having their own private insurance and Medicare or Medicaid. There are the services out there. It just takes some time to navigate to figure out exactly where they can get them at. And that's where like a case manager, through Champaign-Urbana Public Health's infectious disease section is very helpful because they are very well acquainted with all the different things that are out there. And most people that are diagnosed in this area are referred to a case manager so they can make sure they get their services in line.
What's it like today? And I'm asking you because you're a person who is HIV positive yourself, and so you have to live with the disease and all the medical care needed. What does that mean? What sort of medical maintenance do you have to pay attention to on a day-to-day basis?
Well, the biggest one is, of course, remembering to take my medications every day. I mean, I'm fortunate that I just have one pill every day that I have to take for my HIV. But I know a lot of people that take a lot more than that. Then there's always the routine office visits to the doctor and get blood work every 3 months. So it's just kind of trusting your own body when it tells you it's time to slow down a little bit because you're doing too much. You know that you have to, because I've found my own personal experience, if I don't, that's when I start not feeling like I should, like I start getting sick. I feel more susceptible. But I think that can be said for a lot of people too with any kind of illness that they may have, that you just have to listen to your body a lot more.
So daily life is kind of normal?
It's been long enough that I've been living with the disease now that I don't know how else you can describe it, but I feel like I live a fairly normal life. I work a 40-hour week. I see friends. I go out on weekends and to dinner or to a movie, those kind of things. So in many ways, my life is normal. The only time that it isn't is, I think, when I stop and look back at what it was like 10, 15, 20 years ago, how people lived before the advent of all the modern medications, before the disease was understood as well as it is today. And you kind of wonder, what would happen if all these medications were to go away, if something was to happen that it would stop? Would my life be like theirs was back then?
That's Mike Brenner, the director of GCAP, the Greater Community AIDS Project. He spoke with Jim Meadows. GCAP will mark World AIDS Day with a free showing of the documentary We Were Here, The AIDS Years in San Francisco, today at 5:30 p.m. at the Illinois Terminal Building in downtown Champaign. You can hear more of Jim Meadows' interview with Mike Brenner and learn more about GCAP and World AIDS Day at our website, will.illinois.edu. And coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the broadcast day, we will bring you Talk of the Nation. We'll preempt the 1 o'clock broadcast of Fresh Air today in favor of Talk of the Nation. Gary Nell will be the guest in the 1 o'clock hour. He officially becomes NPR CEO today, and Gary will join host Neil Conan for a conversation with NPR listeners about NPR's role in media and our future direction as public broadcasters. That's today at 1 o'clock. You can hear Fresh Air today at 7 p.m.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 1st of December, 2000.